The unmistakable sound of Herb Alpert on the first hit for Herb and the Tijuana Brass. 1962's The Lonely Bull. Over the years, Herb Alpert has sold more than 70 million records, 28 albums, five of which went to number one. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, an eight-time Grammy winner, received the National Medal of the Arts from President Barack Obama. He's also a producer, the co-founder of A&M Records, an artist, a sculptor, a philanthropist, and he's out on tour with his talented wife, Lonnie Hall, and will be here in New England for a show on the 30th at the Portsmouth Music Hall. We had a chance to talk with the great Herb Alpert last week. Well, hello there, Herb. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. Get a chance to do what I love to do. I'm blowing the horn right now, practicing, getting ready for the concerts.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah, you've had a busy spring and early summer, and you head back out on the road on the 25th in Charlotte, and you'll be up here in New England for a couple of shows, the 29th at the Cabot Theater in Beverly, Mass., and at the Portsmouth Music Hall on Sunday, July 30th. What will people see when they go out to check out you and your supremely talented wife?
they're going to hear some good music. You know, we've been doing about 50 concerts a year and having a great time. We'll do a, you know, obviously, I'll do a Tijuana Brass medley, and my wife, Lonnie, will sing a Brazilian, Brazil 66 medley. And then around that, it'll be just some great songs that we love to play. It's very spontaneous, but it'll be, we've had tremendous reaction for the last 15 years. And I'm doing it, you know, not as a victory tour for me. I'm doing it because I love to do it. I've had this opportunity to sell so many records. Or CDs, or whatever you call them these days. Maybe they're zeros and ones now. But I feel like, you know, I get a chance to make a certain amount of people really happy with the music, and it makes me feel good, gives me energy, and that's why I'm out there.
And is it perhaps more fun than it was in the days when you were doing the Tijuana Brass records, you know, essentially note for note when you performed live?
Well, it's note for note, but it's very spontaneous. I try to be in the moment of my life when I'm playing. So it's actually more fun for me now because it's easier for me to play the trumpet at my age now than it was 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
Well, you picked up the trumpet at an early age. You were, I think, 8 years old in a music appreciation class. And you've said the trumpet gave you your voice. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm an introvert. I'm a card-carrying introvert. So when I was 8 years old, and I was struggling making a sound out of the trumpet because I thought you'd just blow hot air into it, and, you know, obviously you have to buzz into the mouthpiece. Once I started getting a little sound out of it and having fun doing it, I realized that this instrument was talking for me. It was saying the things that I couldn't get out of my mouth. So it's been a great friend of mine for so many years, and then it backfired. I had a problem playing the trumpet for a while. And around 1969, 1970, I was going through a divorce, and I don't know, emotionally I just couldn't get the notes out right. I was kind of stuttering through the instrument. So I took lessons from this teacher in New York City. His name was Carmine Caruso. And he had a reputation of being the troubleshooter. You know, he would teach brass players from around the world who were having, you know, some types of problems with what they were trying to express themselves. So I made contact with Carmine, and when I met him, I said, "Carmine, what am I doing wrong? Am I? You think it might be the trumpet? It might be the mouthpiece? It might be, you know, the setup that I have here?" He said, "Let me tell you something, kid." He said, "You're the instrument. That trumpet is just a megaphone. That you just put that trumpet to your lips and it's just amplifying the sounds." He says, "You're the instrument. The sound comes from inside you." So that was a big aha for me, and ever since then, I just approached it from another angle, and it's been great.
You had a great teacher early in life too. What did Ben Klaskin teach you?
Well, he was a great Russian trumpet player. He was first trumpet with the San Francisco Symphony, and he was into the mechanics of how to play the horn. Every time he'd hit a very high note, and then he'd hit my hand on his the bottom of his stomach, where he said, "That sound, the sound needs to come from here." You know, that you take a big breath and the da, you know. So he was teaching me that, and oddly enough, during the pandemic, where I was kind of sequestered in my own home, I was thinking about all these teachers that had said, you know, certain things to me, because everybody has a different way of approaching the instrument. So I started thinking about, you know, what he was saying and what the other teachers had to say, and I started going back in history in my mind of, you know, these lessons, and I started working on it in a different way for the last 3 years, and it's been a whole new life for me. I mean, I don't know how to explain this, but, you know, I wake up thinking about painting, sculpting, and making music, and always, you know, like it's a pebble at a time. You never get to the promised land. You never get to that place where you think, oh, I got this covered, now what else? You never get there, because there's always, well, Dizzy Gillespie was a friend of mine, and Dizzy used to say, the closer I get, the farther it looks.
Well, like a lot of kids, I took up trumpet when I was 8 years old, because I was always listening to albums like South of the Border and Going Places. How in the world did you develop that incredible tone of yours that you only have to hear for a moment and know, well, that's Herb Alpert?
Well, that's what we're all looking for. You know, when I tell students about, you know, what's the secret of my success, you know, there's no secret. You know, I was just probing, practicing, listening, and trying to find my own voice, because nobody wants to hear, you know, somebody, a copy, carbon copy of someone else's style. And I tried to do that for a while. I was trying to play like Louis Armstrong or Miles Davis or any of the trumpet players I really, Harry James was another one. And I came to the realization, who wants to hear that? I mean, they've already done it. So I was looking for my own voice. And when I hit on this Tijuana Brass style, because I heard these records with some artists, you know, recording their instrument or their voice, overdubbing their voice and creating this sound. I tried doing that with the trumpet, and out came the Tijuana Brass sound. So, yeah, I'm very thankful that I found my voice, and I stuck to it, because after I had that first big record, The Lonely Bull, in 1962, I got letters from people. And this one letter from this lady in Germany said, "Thank you, Mr. Alpert, for sending me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana." And I kind of chuckled when I read the letter, and then I thought to myself, wow, that music was so visual for her that it transported her about 8,000 miles to Tijuana, Mexico. So I thought about, I want to make that type of music, the music that kind of takes you someplace. Opposed to, you know, like elevator music, which is nice, it's soothing, but it doesn't take you any particular, it's not supposed to. Mm. But the music I'm making, I'm always trying to do something that's uniquely my own. If I play a song that's a standard song or a song that people recognize, I try to do it in a way that hasn't been done quite that way before, for my own pleasure. I mean, the truth of it all is I make music for myself. I'm not trying to anticipate what the public might like. If I like it and it gives me goosebumps and it makes me feel good when I listen to it after I play it, I'll put it out and see if someone else might feel the same way.
We're talking with Herb Alpert here on Downtown. Well, you're still doing that today. The most recent album is so good, Sunny Side of the Street. And I think my favorite cut on there is a fantastic new arrangement and version of Little Anthony's Going Out of My Head.
I mean, I'm doing that all day.
I love it. That is great. So 1965, but you had such a big year. The Whipped Cream and Other Delights album came out. That blew up. It drove up the sales of earlier albums along the way. So how did a self-described introvert handle that level of attention?
Well, the attention is fine on the stage. It doesn't bother me. I'm great. I can play for thousands of people, and I feel good about it. No, it's just that one-on-one. With one person, I'm fine. With two, it's okay. All of a sudden, when there's a crowd, a lot of people around it, I don't know. I just get anxious about it. Don't feel that comfortable.
I tell people it's the same thing. I tell people I'm a professional extrovert, but in real life, I'm an introvert.
Oh, well, now that's interesting.
I want to talk about one of your biggest records, 1968's This Guy's in Love with You. You're the only artist to ever have number one songs as both a musician and as a vocalist. Was it the producer of the TV special's idea to have you sing that Burt Bacharach song?
Well, he didn't pick out the song. He said, why don't you try singing a song? I'm tired of photographing you with a trumpet in your mouth. So I called one of my best friends, da-da-da, Burt Bacharach. Hey, so I said, Burt, is there a song you find yourself maybe whistling in the shower or a song? Maybe you didn't get the right recording. And he sent me This Girl's in Love with You that he recorded with Dionne Warwick. And I thought I could handle the song. Obviously, the lyric needed to be changed for a male voice, and it all fell into place. Bert did the arrangement. He played piano on it, and we had a jolly good time. Except, you know, I had a little conference with Bert at one point when the song ends and I pick up the trumpet and start playing the melody. I wanted this little space there, and Bert said, don't do that. Don't do that space there. The radio's not going to like it. So this is when I really realized, man, I got to go with my own gut. I had to put that space there. I think the space works. Mm. And, of course, after the record was number one in the country, Bert said, yeah, that was a good idea to put the space there.
And is it true, Herb, that vocal that we heard on record was the first take?
It was the first take.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just seeing if the key was right. So I went to the studio after we had the track, and I sang it, and walked into the control room, and there were a bunch of singers there and musicians. They said, don't touch that. Don't touch that voice. I said, what do you mean, don't touch it? He said, don't touch it. It was perfect. I said, I was just doing it as a demo. He said, no, you communicated the feeling perfectly. Leave it. Anyways, that was the voice, and I overdubbed a couple, eye candy things in that record. But other than that, it was that first voice.
You're a partnership with Jerry Moss, who created one of the great record companies of all time, known as a real artist company. And is that because, much like with your own music, it wasn't about making hits, it was about getting the best out of those individual artists?
Well, and it was also, we didn't want to get the beat of the week. We didn't want listen to the top 10. We didn't want to get records that sounded like those records. We wanted to be original. And also, we were in the artists that travel the road less traveled, the ones, the Cat Stevens of the world, or the Carpenters, or the artists that just kind of had something to say that wasn't quite what was happening with the record charts at the moment. And we felt if we get great artists that have the passion and the intentions are right, it would just be a matter of time before they would flag themselves down to the runway and find out, what the audience might like.
But you were such a great A&R guy, too. You had recorded a version of Close to You, but you knew that would be perfect for Karen and Richard.
Well, I thought I was going to release that record for myself when I did it, and then I tell this in concert because it really happened. I my head engineer at A&M, Larry Levine, who's a dear friend of mine, I said, after we mixed the record, I said, Larry, be honest with me, how do I sound singing this? And he said, you sound terrible singing this song. So I said, what do you mean I sound terrible? He says, it doesn't fit you. It's like maybe the wrong. He says, I don't know. I just don't feel it. So I put it away in my drawer. And in 1970, I did. I gave it to Richard Carpenter. they recorded it once, and I heard the recording, and I told them, no, that's not, we got to try that one again, because Karen was playing drums, and she was a very good drummer, but not a recording drummer. You know, she had a light sound, and it didn't seem like it was radio friendly, this record. So, you know, they got the Wrecking Crew.
Mm. Get Hal Blaine on those drums, right?
Yeah, it was Hal Blaine playing drums, and that put it over the top. Of course, it was a great arrangement by Richard Carpenter. He did all the vocal arrangements too, and it was the two of them. It wasn't just Karen with that magnificent voice. It was the two of them, and Richard knew exactly how to get the most out of her magnificent talent.
He also signed a wonderfully talented group, Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66, and their talented lead vocalist. You've got a big anniversary. Will it be 50 years of marriage to Lonnie later this year?
Yeah, I'm a lucky guy. I married an angel. You know, it was all serendipitous because Lonnie's from Chicago. Sergio happened to hear her at a club she was singing at, signed her to his group. And when Jerry Moss, my partner, and I auditioned them in 1966, we were knocked out. There was something about that sound and Sergio's talent that, you know, made us want to sign them, and we did. Lonnie and I became friends. I produced the first few albums by Sergio. I did that record that really broke things loose for them, Mashkinada, and... Oh, I couldn't be more grateful. We've had a wonderful relationship. She's a world-class singer and a world-class person.
And did you know that she was the perfect person for you when she, I think this came up in the documentary, that she called you out for not being true to yourself?
Well, she's an honest, you know, she was a street lady from Chicago. And, you know, after the Lonely, I got all that success. I bought a house in the big part of L.A. and, you know, Beverly Hills, and I had a party one night. Ex-wife and Sergio and the group was invited, along with lots of other friends. She was there, and the day or two after that, we were traveling together because we were traveling with Sergio and the group for about a month or two, opening the show for us. She came over to me on the airplane and said, thank you, Mr. Albert, you know, very formal, for inviting me to the party. I said, well, thanks for coming. Did you have a good time? She kind of stared out into space. She looked at me and said, well, not really. I said, well, what was the problem? She says, that house doesn't look anything like you.
Wow.
And I remember stopping for about 30 seconds, kind of staring at her, thinking, holy man, she saw right through me. That's what I was feeling. So, yeah, one thing led to another, and we're great together.
Well, that's obvious. So right there. You had a big hit, what, 17 years after The Lonely Bull. You're back on the top of the charts in 1979 with the wonderful song Rise, brought to you by your nephew, Randy. But it sounds like a key component of that record's success was that you didn't give in to the urge to do what was popular at the time and go with a more disco sound.
Well, he originally had it as a disco record. It was designed to be played at 120 beats per minute, 120 beats per minute. Which doesn't mean anything to the public out there, but that's that typical boom, 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 boom disco groove. And I said, look at me, this is a beautiful melody. Let's slow this thing down. This was in the studio while we were recording some other things, and then that song came about that we were going to play it. So I said, let's do it slowly so people can dance together, make it more sexy and sensual. And we slowed it down, and that was another case where that was just the first take. We did it. Abraham Laboriel was playing bass, and he put on this beautiful thumping bass line that my nephew Randy designed. And one thing led to another, and the song just was a huge success. It was didn't catch me off guard, because when I heard it in playback in the studio, I got a little one of those feelings of, oh, this is good. I remember going up to Julius Wechter, who played marimba on it. He was a friend of mine, and he was staring out the control room window, and I came up from behind him, and I said, Julius, man, what do you think of this one? And he turned around and said, I hate it. I said, what do you mean you hate it? He said, I don't like that boom, boom, boom bass drum. I said, man, you're missing the boat. Listen to it without thinking. Just listen to it. And, yeah, he was another guy that came up to me after it was number one in the country. He said, yeah, I know what you mean about it now.
Well, you're still making great music. I mentioned the album you released last year, Sunny Side of the Street. I understand a new one is coming soon, maybe as soon as this fall.
That you have to ask my nephew. You know, I don't handle that anymore. I just leave it to him. I think he said in September, but I'm not sure.
Now, when it comes to your art, it's more than just music. Your painting has been displayed all over the world. You began sculpting in the early 80s, and I read in an interview where you said that whether it's music, sculpting, painting, for you, it's always about the feel.
And I think that's what it is, period. Now, all the art forms are the same. And if you think too hard, if you see a painting that you try to analyze, or a sculpture you try to analyze, you're missing the boat. Or a song, you know, the song either really gets you or it doesn't. You know how sometimes you're driving in your car and you hear a song and you say, whoa, what's that? I want to like to hear that again. That's because you're not thinking. It's just it hits you in the right spot. So I think a lot of people try to overanalyze art, and I don't think you can. I think it's all about a feeling. It's a mysterious concept, but you know, it's like when you see an artist on the screen that might not be that good looking, or they might be, you know, have the wrong elements, but there's something great about what they do on that screen, and you can't take your eyes off of them. And in that same scene, there's a bunch of beautiful people, but you got this other guy that just is a wonderful communicator of a feeling. And that's, I don't know, it's hard to explain this, but I think it's the feel. I think that's why people, some people like my music. Mm. That's what I try to put out there. I'm just trying to put out a feeling that gets me when I hear it, and then I feel, well, if I can feel something from it, maybe some other people might.
And did you learn some of that when you worked as a young man with Lou Adler and you wrote for Sam Cooke?
Oh, absolutely. Sam Cooke was something special. We worked for that company that when Sam had You Send Me, and then Lou and I started writing songs with Sam. We wrote Wonderful World. Don't know much about history. We wrote that song with him. But I watched him. I watched the way he operated. He was very seat of the pants. You know, he wasn't like a schooled musician, but he had something. And I remember him telling me he'd carry around this notebook with him that had a bunch of lyrics, and he was excited about this one lyric. He showed it to me. He said, Herbie, what do you think of this lyric? I looked at it, and I was thinking to myself, I didn't say it to him. I said, man, this is the corniest lyric I've ever seen. But I wasn't going to tell him that. I said, well, what does the song sound like? He picked up his guitar, started playing this corny lyric. I looked at him like, wow, what kind of magic just happened? But, you know, the way where he put the notes, the feeling he had while singing it, his passion while singing it, I was thinking to myself, man, it ain't what you do. It's the way how you do it. And that was the thing that he taught me, and it stuck with me, you know, to this moment. I think that's all about that. It's all about the way you do it.
I work with high school theater students, and you have been so generous, you and Lonnie, through the Herb Alpert Foundation, supporting artistic endeavors at UCLA, Cal Arts, the Harlem School of the Arts, and more. Why is arts education so important?
I think music and arts, they unite us all. it's the international code. I mean, it's like, I think we're all creative when we're born, and we have this imagination, and it's kind of, instead of growing into it, we grow out of it, because we're not, our politicians don't seem to get the message, how important it is.
Herb Alpert appearing at the Portsmouth Music Hall with Lonnie Hall on Sunday, July 30th. Herb, thank you so much for the great music through the years, the inspiration, for showing us how to lead an artistic life. It's been a real treat for us to talk with you, and I'm so looking forward to seeing you and Lonnie and the band down in Portsmouth.
Oh, great, Rich. Thank you so much. You won't be disappointed. We do it for the right reasons, and love to see as many people as we can there.